On Tech News Today, we've got new revelations from the Edward Snowden trove of documents. Plus, Kinect for Windows version 2 is shipping soon. We'll tell you all about how it works and why you might want to use it. And a crowdsourced space program goes into operation, and they're using an old spacecraft that's been out of commission since 1997. All that and more coming up right now on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today from Monday, July 7th, 2014. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin. Jason is off this week. Anthony Nielsen is filling in for Jason. And our co-anchor today and every Monday from now on is Lindsay Turrentine, who is the editor-in-chief at CNET Reviews. Welcome at long last, Lindsay Turrentine.
So I am pretty excited.
You are our Monday person now. Everybody's
your Monday person now, and I'm fresh back from Italy, so I'm so relaxed and ready to go.
That's fantastic. I took a recent online thing where they ask you a bunch of questions about what you like, what you don't like, and then it tells you what country you're supposed to live in, and they told me Italy. So,
I loved it. It felt a lot like home, which is kind of nice. It was like home, but with slightly more difficult driving and a little more rain.
And better Italian food.
Much better Italian food. Although then I spent a few days in Switzerland where the driving was amazing.
Really?
Yeah. So,
That's fantastic. Where were you in Italy, may I ask?
We were in Tuscany and Rome and a little bit in Florence.
Very nice. Beautiful.
It was beautiful.
Well, welcome back to reality.
Thank you.
We're glad you're here, even if it's a tragic that you had to return so soon. But
what a nice way to return.
Yes, absolutely. Well, let's jump into the news. The Washington Post reported over the weekend that the NSA targeted the communication of ordinary internet users far more than the legally targeted suspects. 90% of the people involved in intercepted conversations were not the targets of that surveillance, and nearly half were American citizens. The report was based on a four-month investigation of documents leaked by Edward Snowden and Lindsay Turrentine. This is yet another revelation. Now that we've pretty much, I think we've got all the basic news out there, now journalists are going back and doing analysis of what has already been sort of out there. And in this case, they spent 4 months working on this thing, and they counted up and did a lot of apparently data crunching on this thing and found that, a huge number of people are being sort of surveilled accidentally as kind of collateral. When you surveil someone, you have to look at their inbox, you collect their inbox information, and they're communicating with people who have nothing to do with any sort of crime or terrorism or plots of any kind. So their information is still available and built into the document, and it's something that is going to be a political problem for President Obama, no doubt. So, I mean, this is really quite a revelation, especially given the numbers. 9 out of 10 are completely innocent people who are supposedly protected by the first by the Bill of Rights, and yet their information is being harvested, they're being surveilled, their private details are being collected and stored. What's a national security agency to do about all this, do you think?
Gosh, if I knew the answer to that question, I'd be in charge. It's obviously incredibly troubling because this could be any one of us with our information just sitting there on a database waiting to be used inappropriately at some future time. Because as we know through the history of surveillance, even if intentions are good initially, eventually something usually goes wrong. But that said, 10% of these were actually troubling instances. And what was really interesting about this story to me is that so much of this information, even, less than 10%, but still led to some really important discoveries, some of which the Washington Post wouldn't even reveal because they were part of ongoing terrorism investigations. And there were some big deal things uncovered through this process. So it's just a really tough problem. And I don't envy the NSA, to be honest.
Yeah, even the vague suggestions of the kinds of things that they uncovered were unsettling. For example, they said that they had information about a secret overseas nuclear project. I don't like the sound of that. Double dealing by an ostensible ally, Could that be Germany? And could that be why the U.S. is refusing to not spy on Germany, which is causing a rift between the two countries? A military calamity that befell an unfriendly power. I'd love to know about that one. That sort of thing. They also discovered and provided sketchy details about the arrest and capture in Abbottabad of Mohammed Tahir Shahzad, who's a Pakistan-based bomb builder. They had to track 50 fake accounts in order to nail this guy. And that gives you some sense of what the NSA is trying to do and what their challenges are, that they, you know, here's a person with 50 alias accounts that they have to sort of figure out somehow that this is the same person so they can, you know, track him down and collect them. They also talked about how some of the surveillance led to the arrest of a Indonesian terrorist bombing suspect. So that's, you know, interesting information. And again, this is likely to be, and it should be, a political issue for President Obama. There's got to be some way to go after the bad guys and expunge as soon as humanly possible the private details of people who are not suspected of any crimes at all, or figure out how to surveil suspects without surveilling everyone that they interact with. So that's a really interesting story. Well, in more techie, geeky news, Lindsay, we've got a new goodies bit of kit coming for Windows users. Can you tell us about that?
That's right. Microsoft is accepting pre-orders right now for Kinect for Windows, the second generation of this. And starting on July 15th, developers will be able to spend $200 to get their own early version of Kinect for Windows. And, you know, Kinect for Windows is supposed to be it's supposed to work within a smaller physical area than Kinect for Xbox, and it's supposed to do things like allow us to interact with computers using motion control. There are some other products on the market that do this, and here to talk with us about it is Dan Ackerman from CNET, who knows just about everything there is to know about Windows PCs and Kinect.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan.
Good to see you guys. This is the second version of Kinect. You know, when Kinect was first announced for the Xbox 360 console several years ago, some enterprising guys immediately took that and said, hey, I can hook this up to a PC and make it work. And they did some really cool sort of augmented reality and virtual reality sort of experiments with it. And Microsoft said, okay, we're going to capitalize on this and put out a Windows version. Now they've got a new version. It looks and feels a lot like the one that comes with the Xbox One console now. Interestingly, of course, they've now taken that Kinect out of the required bundle for the Xbox One. Now you can buy a Kinectless Xbox One, but now they're pushing it on Windows. You know, seems like a good idea, especially when you pair it with that Oculus Rift headset that's also kind of still in development. That seems to be the most logical use. You still have to sort of have all this extra add-on equipment for your laptop or your desktop. I saw a couple years ago at E3 people building Kinect into laptops as kind of an experiment, and none of those models ever came out, but it was built like right into like the base of the laptop. You know, it remains to be seen whether or not people or consumers are going to go out and buy like an actual unit that'll sit on top of their machines.
Now, I remember the rumors when this thing was in early development that it was going to be so accurate it could read lips, like HAL 9000 or something like that. Is it really like super high definition recognition?
I'm not sure we're at the lip reading stage yet, but if you've used the new Kinect with the Xbox One versus the old Kinect on the Xbox 360, that's the closest approximation of the abilities here. It is a lot more accurate in terms of body tracking and joint tracking. You can actually see, let's say, individual fingers rather than just your hands, the giant glob, which was the old Kinect. And I think voice recognition is going to continue to be super, super important for these things. But then again, people have tried to build motion control into computers for years. I actually looked back right before I came on here and found a 2008 laptop review I wrote for when Toshiba was trying to build motion controls into laptops using the webcam that was built into them. Terrible idea. Didn't work at all.
So what do you think? What do you think the promises of this is? What are we going to potentially get out of this? And why is Microsoft charging $100 more than it costs to bundle this exact technology into an Xbox?
Sure, because you're getting like a developer's, you know, version of it. This is not the final consumer version of the hardware, and you have to separately get the Kinect SDK in order to even program stuff for it. I think what they want to do is put these units out there and see what enterprising programmers and startup guys come up with, particularly when you combine it with some of the augmented reality goggle stuff that's happening right now, whether it's the Sony version, or whether it's the Oculus version, or some other competitors out there. I think this will be something where Microsoft kind of sets up the hardware and then leaves it up to the same people who hacked the original console Kinect to work on PCs to find cool stuff to do with it. Obviously, games are really big, but I think even real estate is an untapped huge field for augmented reality of all kinds, the visual kind and this motion kind.
Now, my own view is that one of the problems with in-the-air gesture technology, including this and others, Leap Motion, for example, is that in-the-air gestures to control things is not a natural human interface, if you want to call it an interface. We use gestures for communication, and I have the feeling that once the application developers create communication technologies and also the gesture equivalent of voice recognition technology will be much further ahead. For example, you can imagine technologies that we've all seen demoed where you have an avatar that's a cartoon character or something like that, but it mimics everything you do on your face and with your body and your hands and all that kind of stuff. That's one way to use it for communication. But another way is for software, artificial intelligence software of some kind, to recognize your natural gestures. A shrug means you're not sure, shaking your head, all that kind of thing. And once that hits, I think that gesture interfaces are going to be a big deal. And that's probably, Microsoft may know that as well, which is why they're pushing this so hard at developers. And, of course, they had a huge boon when the Kinect first hit with people, makers and experimenters and scientists and so on, using Kinect to do all kinds of amazing things. And, of course, YouTube is packed with really cool demos of Kinect hacks of various kinds. Now, Dan Ackerman, do you think that this this is going to be more popular than previous versions? I mean, already Microsoft, for example, is starting to offer a version of Kinect, of Xbox without Kinect, and they're doing that mainly for the price. But do you see this just taking off at any time in the near future?
I think you have to look at it from two points of view. One, there's the developer point of view, where is this a cool tool to try to develop stuff from? And maybe I can later port that to using the webcam that's built into every laptop and every tablet that's out there. That's one level. And I think what you were pointing at was exactly right, when it can actually kind of look at your facial expression and see whether you like the video you're watching, or you don't like something, or you're interested or not paying attention, and kind of divine some sort of user input from that. That's really interesting stuff. I think on the consumer level, I don't think anybody on the consumer level really bought the Kinect for Windows original version and hooked it up to their PCs unless they were a real enthusiast hobbyist who really wanted to do stuff with this. I don't see consumers also running out and buying Kinect version 2 when it's available in a consumer form, which it's not even yet, and hooking it up to their computers. But I do think that you'll see people continue to try to build motion control and gesture control and body recognition stuff into existing machines, whether it's using the built-in webcams or some new sensors maybe you can build in, right into the keyboard tray. That said, all the examples of this we've seen to date have not been commercially successful. It may end up just being a hardcore hobbyist thing that, regular Joe on the street just doesn't care about. They just want to go on Facebook.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. And Dan Ackerman is available at CNET.com, and you can find him on Twitter under the name Dan Ackerman. Thanks, Dan, for coming on Tech News Today.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Dan.
Well, a 36-year-old spacecraft was fired up again last week after being abandoned in space by NASA in 1997. The resurrection of the International Sun-Earth Explorer 3 probe was initiated by a private team after a crowdfunding effort to raise money for the project. Elizabeth Howell writes about space, and she wrote about this story for Scientific American and joins us on the phone. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Glad you're here. Now, how do you bring a spacecraft back to life? How did they do it?
Well, what they had to do first was to figure out how to communicate with it, because after all, it had been about, 20 years since they last talked this thing? And if you can imagine even just trying to communicate with your computer, your desktop computer from 1997, imagine trying to talk to a spacecraft that was built in 1978, and they haven't even talked to it for 20 years. And so it was a long process, basically, of going back, trying to look at the original drawings, tracking down NASA engineers who used to work on the project, and then, of course, getting permission from NASA to go and communicate with it. And then once you get all that lined up, then you need to go find the telescope time and the radar and everything that you need to get in touch with it. And it worked. That's the most amazing thing about it. After all this work and all the crowdfunding they did, it worked.
So, Elizabeth, what was the original mission of this spacecraft, and why had it been abandoned for so long?
Well, originally it was supposed to be looking at it did a whole bunch of things, actually, over its lifetime. It was taking a look at activity on the sun. It chased after a couple of comets, including Halley's. But the thing is, as spacecraft get older, NASA only has so many funds to allocate. And so, of course, it has to kind of look at its portfolio, so to speak, just like any kind of business, and say, well, is the spacecraft doing what we need to do, or do we need to sort of move our resources to something else? And so I imagine around 97, it was looking at some of the other projects that were coming down the line. They said, you know, we've had the spacecraft working for almost 20 years, and probably it's a good time to turn it off. But by turning it off, they didn't deactivate it permanently, obviously. And when the people that were working on this project now, the ISEE3 reboot project, as they call themselves, happened to notice that the spacecraft was coming by Earth again, they thought, well, you know, maybe we should try and talk to it and use it for something else.
So what are they planning to do with it now that they've got its attention?
They've got its attention, and the next thing that they have to do is get it on the right trajectory. It's kind of going in a way that is not convenient to do long-term communications with it. And so now that they have successfully done a roll maneuver just to get it ready, really, the next thing they're going to do is actually fire its engines and make it go in a stable spot where they can communicate with it long-term. And then that's when they say they're going to figure out what to do with it, because as the co-founders or the co-leader of the group was telling me, Keith Cowling, it's a lot easier to begin these discussions with a working spacecraft than a spacecraft that might be working. So that's where they're sort of at.
It's so interesting. Do you think that there will be anything unexpected that will come out of this particular project?
Oh, there have been a lot of unexpected things. I mean, they tried at one point to be sending some commands through it, and it wasn't responding, and they had to try and kind of hack it and figure out what was going on, and it took a lot of jiggery, pokery, and engineering talk to try and get that finished, but they finished it, and, you know, thank goodness, because it is still working up there, and it's really great to see.
Now, they're commanding it using an observatory in Puerto Rico. I think that's the big giant one that they showed in the movie Contact, right?
Yes, it showed in the movie Contact, and it also was part of the pivotal fight scene in GoldenEye. It's called Arecibo, and it has a famous satellite dish that you can sort of look at. And anyway, what they did was they were communicating with this particular observatory through a command center in California, actually. It's a former McDonald's that's around the NASA Ames Center, and these people happened to find out that the building wasn't being used for anything else, and they got NASA's permission to go and squat in it. And they've been sitting there ever since, you know, leasing it and getting all their work done. They also do some work for another project called the Lunar Orbiter Recovery Project, where they're processing old images from the lunar orbiter back in the 1960s. So it's quite impressive.
Well, it's a fascinating project, and it was a really great article. I really appreciated reading it. You can find Elizabeth Howell at elizabethhowell.ca and on Twitter at Howell Space. Thank you, Elizabeth Howell, for coming on Tech News Today.
And thank you for having me.
Well, Lindsay, the little details about Apple's rumored iWatch just keep pouring in. It's pretty clear that they're going to build one. What's the latest in that department?
Well, according to CNBC, Apple poached a Swiss watch sales executive for the iWatch launch. This happened probably as recently as last week. They poached Jean-Claude Bivet, I think that's how you pronounce it, who is the head, I'm sorry, that was not the name of the executive. It was Jean-Claude Bivet, who is the head of LVMH watches brands, including Tag Heuer, told CNBC that a recent sales executive poaching had happened and that somebody went to Apple to help Apple launch the iWatch. And he was kind of candid about it and said, you know, I would have been insulted, except Apple's not a direct competitor, which is sort of an interesting position to take. But what's so interesting about this is that some analysts are saying that Apple's been trying to poach these Swiss watch executives specifically, and maybe not very successfully over time. And the idea is that they really want to be able to tout the iWatch as a Swiss-made watch, because that's such a respected term for watches, and it really communicates some exact behavior and precision, and that it's a really high value product. And we know that Apple likes to go out with its launches with very they like their initial launches to be extremely lofty, and they want people to feel like a purchase of the product, especially a new product, is going to be sort of an elite purchase. So this is one more nod in that direction.
Yeah, the idea that Apple is not a direct competitor sounds like famous last words, especially since they're not hiring somebody who is expert at building watches. They're hiring somebody who's expert at selling luxury watches in the watch channel, and, you know, to jewelry stores and other places where watches are sold. So I would be more nervous than he is letting on about this. You know, the idea that you hire somebody who's got the connections in the watch business, not to gadget geeks. This isn't about, you know, it sounds like they're not talking about, you know, a Best Buy move. It sounds like they're talking about Tiffany's and wherever else you buy these expensive high-end Swiss watches. So this is really quite an interesting story, I think, for that reason. You know, it's one thing to hire experts at creating something. It's another thing to hire experts at marketing outside the place where you normally market. And that's what this is all about.
And this is pretty classic Apple. It was interesting that a luxury goods analyst named Mario Ortelli told CNBC that that most of the Swiss watch manufacturers have been trying to distance themselves from this project a little bit because they are worried. And his explanation was that the Swiss makers sort of feel like an Apple watch is made in Cupertino/China. And that's not going to carry the same luxury weight as a Swiss watchmaker. But I think you're right to suggest that maybe there's more going on than that. And they really should be a little bit nervous because if Apple knows how to do anything, it's to make a launch product seem like a luxury.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure Nokia at some point said that they weren't nervous about Apple because they're not a direct competitor either. So you got to watch out for these Silicon Valley giants because they will crush your industry if they can. Well, make sure your phone is charged before flying. New Transportation Security Administration rules announced yesterday required that mobile phones be turned on during security checks. That's right. They're going to force you to turn it on to prove that it can boot. And if it can't boot, they won't be allowed on some inbound flights to the United States. Another change is that Apple iPhones and Samsung Galaxy phones are being given extra scrutiny above other brands at security checkpoints. Richie Jennings is a writer and analyst who specializes in security and joins us now to talk about this. Welcome, Richie.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. So
hey,
why
Lindsay.
The why?
Good to meet you.
Hello.
Why the new rules? Why are they suddenly forcing people to turn on their phones in some cases?
So, right, stand by for some acronyms or initialisms.
I'm ready.
ACDs. ACDs, artfully concealed devices, we are told. And the other buzzword that we have to know about is AQAP, which is Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, also known as Al-Qaeda's franchise in Yemen.
Sounds like a BFD.
Well, it could be. The intelligence chatter, we're told, is saying that they're expecting AQAD to come up with bombs disguised as phones or disguised as other smarty devices. So they started off by telling us a few days ago, and, you know, in case you can't guess from the strange way I talk, I'm the other side of the Atlantic, right? So this story is all about people traveling into the United States. And they're telling us, you know, if you're going to be flying to the U.S. anytime soon, well, be prepared for something to happen at security. We're not really going to tell you what it is because, hey, that might help the terrorists. Shoot me. As days go on, more information dribbles out because, you know, you're hardly going to keep this sort of stuff secret, seeing as people are experiencing this every day as they fly into the United States. So they are paying more attention to people's devices like phones and tablets. They are asking you to turn them on to prove that they really are phones and tablets and not things that look like phones and tablets that are actually bombs. There's also increased scrutiny of those devices using what some people call swabbing and sniffing tests. So for some time now, certainly at UK airports, and I'm pretty sure I've seen these at other airports as well, there's been a little machine that they've used from time to time to swab down something that they think is interesting. And they put the swab into a machine which sniffs it for chemical residues that might indicate that either you or this device has been in contact with bomb stuff, chemicals that might explode. These guys in the Yemen, they're supposedly the people behind the, do you remember the printer bombs that were discovered a few years ago? One was in the UK, one was in Dubai, and then there was another device in Yemen a year or two after that. They're also supposedly the people behind the underwear bomber that failed, but also significantly, it seems like our security forces failed to come up with the fact that he was coming over. So the fact that that it failed was a blessing.
The problem, it seems to me, is that if you can get a bomb into a device the size of a smartphone, you can build a similar type of thing inside of a laptop, and a laptop that can still boot up. So you can imagine, you know, there's plenty of space inside of a laptop for something like that. You can boot it up and show that it's a functioning laptop. So that's a little bit of a concern.
Terrorist ideas, Mike. Yeah. You know, predictably, the commentary of the last few days has all been about, oh, gosh, it's more security theater and, it's either been down that vein or it's been down the vein of, okay, so they want me to turn my phone on so the NSA can squirrel all the information out of it.
Right. I remember when I was in college a million years ago, we actually had to turn our laptops on going through security. That lasted for a while. People got used to it. It's not an incredibly new idea. What's interesting is that right before the 4th of July holiday here in the States, there was a bulletin saying, you know, we're taking extra security precautions that don't have anything to do with terrorism, but have to do with preventing fighters coming in from Syria back to the United States. And I was on one of these flights from Europe that got extra screening. And what the extra screening turned out to be was a person standing on the gangway from the terminal, between the terminal and the plane itself, doing a second or third check of passports. It was sort of an extra, like, we're going to check your passport again before you get on the plane. And now all of a sudden there is a terrorist, or what seems to be sort of a terrorist-related threat. So I feel like there's a little bit more going on here. I don't know. Of course, I know what it is.
It's entirely possible. You know, for some time here in the UK, we've been, at least in the media, the security services have been exercised about UK nationals going over to help their brothers in Syria. And, you know, there's the moral question about, well, some of these folks are going over there to on a humanitarian mission, ostensibly, and they're getting a really hard time from immigration as they go out, trying to actively persuade them not to go to Syria. There's a lot of heartache and anguish here about, you know, whether we should let people go to Syria and restrict their freedom of movement, even though they're UK citizens. And, you know, obviously there's arguments on both sides. Personally, I always take the argument that if you restrict citizens' freedom of anything, then the terrorists have won, right?
Yeah.
But there's always the pragmatic halfway house, right?
Well, in the meantime, make sure your phone is charged because you may have to leave it behind. That's the practical advice out of this, and probably also your laptop as well. There are some reports that, at least one report that I've seen, that they're making you boot up your laptop. So just have everything charged. You might as well carry a little, a little portable charger as well, at least until they ban those as a new risk. Richie Jennings is at richiej.com and also on Twitter at Richie. Thank you, Richie Jennings, for joining us on Tech News Today.
Been a pleasure anytime. Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Well, Lindsay, it looks like video streaming has actually got a new use for some of the new platforms we've been hearing about recently.
Yeah, I think this is such an interesting story. From GigaOM, Google is using video in Android to create interfaces for different devices, including Android Audio. So rather than you using an app that's installed in your dashboard, Google is actually using video to essentially stream some activity that's happening on your Android cell phone, which is plugged into your car in some way. And according to the article, this is sort of a growing trend, and that visualizing interfaces by using a secondary device on the same network is a really easy way to create a stream in sort of the right format for a different type of experience from your handheld device. And so here to talk about this, we have Yanko Reckers, who is a senior writer from GigaOM. And he wrote about this approach for the site.
Hi, guys.
And hi. Jago, how does this approach help Google create an experience that's better for something like a car?
Well, I think the key difference between a car and a mobile device is that cars don't get upgraded every 2 or 3 years. People buy one car every 10 years. And so if you're stuck with the same dashboard, and imagine there would be a version of Android or iOS in there for 10 years, that would be really old technology once the car gets a little dated. So by outsourcing this to the mobile device and then actually just transmitting the user interface to the dashboard, you can kind of push out updates more frequently. The car hardware doesn't have to be that beefed up. And you have a lot more freedom to do things more on the fly and more rapidly, more rapidly, especially onto something that is such a new platform.
And how does it affect the performance? Because, of course, streaming video is a high bandwidth process.
So the way this is going to work with Android Auto anyway is that it is being transmitted, as far as I know, through the USB cable. So you actually plug your phone in, which also then deals with the battery depletion, because once you start streaming video from your phone, you might run out of juice quickly, but this way you actually keep it charged and you transmit it all through your USB cable. So I don't think there should be a big problem. And the other thing is what you're seeing, obviously, is it is a video, but it looks more like a standard screen. So not that much is happening at any time. You don't want it to always change. You don't want a permanent animation running there because you don't want to be distracted while you drive. And if you just have this one screen there with the one menu, even if it's a video, it's relatively low bandwidth because a lot can be done with compression there.
The fact that you had to plug in the phone physically with a cable was a bit of a head-scratcher at Google I.O., but I guess this explains it. They're going to be running this video. Now, do we know if Apple's CarPlay is going to work the same way?
I'm honestly not sure, but I wouldn't be surprised because it makes a lot of sense. And as I wrote my article, Google hasn't been the first one to do this. And a lot of the technology previously actually was based on not even rendering it on a device that is next to whatever you're using or within the same network, but rendering these video streams in the cloud. And one of the pioneers there was OnLive, the cloud gaming service that some people may remember. It's still around, actually, but it was more in the headlines maybe 2-3 years ago because it was very new at that point. And so they kind of pioneered this idea, and since then it has gone to a whole bunch of platforms.
Do you think that this will help Google bring this product to market faster, that it's actually I would imagine it's a much quicker way for them to develop for an entirely new platform rather than reinventing the wheel?
It's faster for them to develop, but it's also, I think, from a business side, a lot faster, because their proposition to car makers now is not you have to take Android and you have to put certain hardware into your car and you have certain specs. Basically, all hardware makers now have to do is interface with an API and be able to render video, which a screen is capable of just because it's a screen, basically. So for a car maker, this is a lot easier. And at the same time, they can also then run other things at the same time. So a lot of cars are going to be able to run Apple system and Android Auto. So it's not an either-or proposition. People don't have to start just building Android cars. I think that was what many people were afraid of. This now is a much lower level of tie-in. So a car maker will be much easier for a car maker to commit to this, I guess.
Hmm. Well, Janko Rutgers is at GigaOhm.com, and you're also Janko. Is that an O at the end or a zero? I can't tell.
On Twitter, it's a zero, and in real life, it's an O.
Okay, all right. Okay, so on Twitter, it's Janck, J-A-N-K, with a zero at the end. Thank you so much for coming on Tech News today.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
A new generation of illegal ATM skimmers is nearly impossible to detect. ATM skimmers, of course, are designed to fool ATM users into swiping their cards on data collection devices rather than on the bank's actual ATM card swipers. Krebs on Security recently researched trends in European ATM skimmers and found that some were so small now that they fit inside the ATM card slot itself instead of on top. Now, Lindsay Turntine, I remember when ATM card skimmers were these massive dashboard-sized things that went over the entire ATM, and then there was a fake interface with fake buttons and fake skimmers and fake everything. And, of course, the whole point of all of this is to get people to, you know, to troll people into swiping the card thinking they're using a regular ATM, but in fact they're just downloading their data, their personal credit card data or bank data, into a place where the crooks can get at it. But this is this is kind of one of the themes of today's show. We talked about the miniaturized and new threat from airline smartphones. Bad guy technology keeps getting better and better too.
I don't have a ton to say about this other than, you know, it's very frustrating. I had this recent experience in Europe where I couldn't actually use my debit card because my password was too long, which is sort of a consumer reaction to this, to just general security problems. Like, well, I'll make my PIN 8 digits long. And in Europe, they actually, ATMs usually don't take more than 6 digits at the most. But this, you know, it just comes to show that having a complicated PIN for your ATM is not any security at all. What is better security is having a chip in your card. And the US has been super slow to adopt that. And really, I think this needs to, in order to combat this kind of problem, it needs to be an overall technology solution rather than just sort of asking users to create more and more complicated ways of protecting their own personal security.
Yeah, that's right. The chip and PIN thing is exactly right. And of course, Krebs on Security mentioned that as well, and threw the U.S. Reticence to embrace that technology under the bus as a major cause of this whole thing. And of course, one of the other attributes of this new trend is that the crooks are also putting hidden spy cameras so that they can record the PIN, and they can just have a video of the person pressing the buttons, and that's how they get the PIN. There are some skimmers that even have mobile chips that can actually communicate and send text messages, so they're actually texting the credit card or the debit card data wirelessly, so they don't have to go back to their physical ATM to collect this. It keeps going until somebody discovers it, and between the time that they install it and the time somebody figures it out, they will have gotten all this stuff via text. So that is a major threat. And again, this is a report coming out of based on European activity, but I'm sure that it's global. And so, you know, look out. They're getting really hard to detect these days.
Yeah, I think one little piece of advice is to, and I'm not, you know, this is not foolproof, but is to try to use the ATM of your bank, because it's going to look familiar to you. And I think, you know, if you go to like a Bank of America or Wells Fargo ATM plugged into a wall, it's unlikely to be as easy to fiddle with because they have a standard look and feel, as opposed to using, you know, those little random kiosks that you find in hotel lobbies, which look all sorts of different ways and would be pretty easy to alter without anybody noticing it. Although it sounds like nothing really helped.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the wars between different companies who want to resurrect delivery services, and it was not clear how committed Google was, but it seems like we've got some new information that indicates that they are, in fact, very committed to this.
Yeah, this morning Recode reported that Google is setting aside more than $500 million, which is, you know, it's a lot, maybe not that much, to expand its Shopping Express services, which is, when you think about it, an attempt to close the retail loop that Amazon long ago dominated and has been dominating for the past 10 years. And the idea is that Google will find a better way when somebody searches for a product via Google to close the loop and to make that product available for the person who's searching for it and, you know, collect a little money along the way. So this is essentially Google's way of making sure that it continues to be competitive with Amazon, who is, you know, now starting to step into Google's territory,
yeah,
with
absolutely
consumer technology products.
And they have a subtle challenge to Amazon that goes beyond simply providing an alternative delivery service, which is that they are pitting themselves as the ally of the retail businesses. And they're no doubt going to retail stores like Toys R Us and Target and so on and saying, look, these Amazon characters are destroying your business. Be our allies. We'll deliver it for you so people will get the same convenience they get from Amazon, but it'll come from you and your stores. And so unlike Amazon, which has these massive high-tech factories with robots flying around grabbing packages and shipping at scale, Google's only – they have distribution centers, but basically the most of the stuff that Amazon does is being done by the retailer, and Google simply collecting it for a couple of hours, getting it on the truck and pushing it out there. So it sounds to me like it's kind of a harder way to go, and it's also a very un-Googly kind of business to be managing trucks and that sort of thing.
I mean, I find it's there's sort of an interesting conundrum, and I think in the end, I would be surprised if this lasts. I mean, I could be eating my words later, but Google is having to create small warehouses, and then it has these deliveries from these other large retailers, houses those products in these warehouses, and then has its own dispatched contract cars go out and make these short-term deliveries. But we've seen Google try things with other retailers before. Wallet hasn't been super successful, and that's relied on having third-party partners. Then I don't know if you remember Google's coupon project that was sort of a Groupon style, working with very small retailers, and that has gone nowhere.
Yeah.
And Google, Google, because it tends to do things on such massive scale, doesn't have a really great track record with individual customer service on the level of a single person. And when you add in sort of physical delivery, there are some real challenges that could come up. I mean, somebody could have a flat tire. How does Google deal with that? And I also think it raises the question of what happens to the small business. I mean, there are a lot of small businesses that are very angry at Amazon, but there are also a lot of small businesses that exist completely because of Amazon. And Amazon has this huge infrastructure built to support small businesses that do their business through Amazon. Google Shopping Express so far does not. So this leaves out small retailers, you know, even in large urban areas that Google's working in. So I think there's some interesting challenges there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Google has a long way to go before they can get anywhere near Amazon in terms of convenience and the reliability of delivery and all the rest. It's an uphill. It's going to be an uphill battle for them, and we'll see where they take it. Well, Lindsay Turrentine, that is the tech news today. Thank you so much. They're talking about you in the chat room. They're saying how awesome you are. And somebody's asking if you're going to be on every Monday. They missed the part of the beginning of the show, which, in fact, you are going to be here every single Monday.
Every single Monday, and next Monday, I promise I'll have better camera equipment.
Sure, why not? and also, between Mondays, where can people find your work?
I run the reviews portion of CNET, so CNET.com, and on Twitter at LTurrentine.
All right, wonderful. We'll see you next Monday. Thank you again for coming on today. And again, we'll see you every single Monday henceforth.
Can't wait.
All right, you can subscribe to Tech News Today on iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, or many other options. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And please follow us on Twitter, Tech News Today TV. You can send us an email at tnt@twit.tv or leave us voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW. Also, please don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight. And every weeknight, I'll be doing tonight's show. Sarah's out. And we want you to join us no matter who's hosting Tech News Tonight at 4 p.m. Pacific again. My name's Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.